I was given a half barrel and a shovel and had to stand up to my knees in the water from 4 o'clock in the morning till 9, when we were given some Indian corn boiled in water, which we are obliged to swallow as fast as we could for fear the rain should come on and melt the salt. We were called again to our task and worked through the heat of the day, the sun flaming upon our heads like fire and raising salt blisters in those parts which were not completely covered. Our feet and legs, from standing in the salt water for so many hours, soon became full of dreadful boils, which eat down in some cases to the very bone, afflicting the sufferers with great torment.
Mary Prince was just one of thousands of slaves in the Caribbean, each of whom had his or her own story. While we may be aware of the narratives of some slaves in the American South, stories from the Caribbean can help to round out the bigger picture of slavery in the Western Hemisphere. I'm Norman Gilliland. This is University of the Air. With me is Shireen Sherrard-Johnson, professor of English at the UW-Madison and author of various books of prose and poetry, including the recently completed biography of Harlem writer Dorothy West, Dorothy West's Paradise, a biography of class and color. She's also written about the role of slavery in the Caribbean salt trade. And welcome to University of the Air.
Thanks, Norman. I'm glad to be here.
Now, a lot of us probably are not even aware of the whole salt trade in the Caribbean. We're probably more familiar with the story of the rum triangle from there. But why do you suppose we're not more familiar with these Caribbean slave stories?
Well, I think that the situation around publication of slave narratives was just different in the Caribbean. In the United States, you had a real interest in developing a distinct American literary tradition, and people like Emerson and Thoreau were very invested in that. And then you had the enslaved authors like Frederick Douglass and Harriet Jacobs come along, and they created the new genre, which was really an innovation on the biography, the autobiography, the history, the political treaties, really a hybrid text that became part of the American, what would be come to be known as American literary tradition. And in the Caribbean, the circumstances could be very varied depending on which colonial power was in charge of the island at a given time. And so we just do not have a Caribbean Harriet Jacobs or Frederick Douglass in the same way. Most of the stories of the enslaved are embedded within other texts, often by white Caribbean or British explorers or planters who kept notes on their experiences and travels. And so we have to look in those texts to find these embedded stories. Mary Prince is a notable exception within that group.
How many of these slave narratives, whether it's in the American South or even in South America or the Caribbean for that matter, how many of them do we have that are actually narrated in some form while the person is still a slave?
Well, so very few. I mean, usually the slave narratives, at least in the U.S. context, are going to be written after a person has successfully escaped.
Makes sense.
And that's true with Mary Prince. So at the point in which so you can think about Harriet Jacobs' narrative from the perspective of her owner, she was still a slave, but from her perspective, she had escaped. But in the context of the Caribbean, we just do not have them, not in English, and that's another challenge. So there are narratives in other languages, but I'm mostly an Anglophone scholar. So in terms of English, it's really just works like Mary Prince, and also there's another narrative of, called the narrative of Luis Asa Asa. But both of these stories are what we would call as told to, that is, not written by the enslaved person or the emancipated person themselves, but told to a ghostwriter or what we would call an amanuensis who took down the story.
I want to touch on this later in greater detail, but I think it's worth mentioning at this point that you've actually taken an interesting approach to the story of Mary Prince and the Caribbean salt trade and the slavery involved, and that is kind of a travelogue approach. And a surprising number of relics, let's say, are still present in the Caribbean that tie directly to the salt trade.
Right. I mean, in some ways, I wanted to go looking for Mary Prince because the document that we have, her history, her voice does come across, even though it was dictated to a ghostwriter. And yet, by visiting the places that she moved through during her enslavement on her way to freedom, that was another way of accessing or recalling her experience. And so that's really in my project what I set out to do was follow in her footsteps to see if I could understand and access more than the archive has that's in print.
So we actually have a sense of her travels in this narrative of hers?
Right. I mean, she documents, you know, you can map where she goes. She's born in Bermuda and at one point is loaned out to a salt plantation in Grand Turk, or the Turks and Caicos, but we think is probably Grand Turk. It's described in her book as Turk's Island because of the shape, and that's how we know it's probably this island. It was a good ways from Bermuda, so she had to travel by boat to get there. And then it was a common practice to in the U.S. as well as in the Caribbean to lend out enslaved peoples to other plantations or other sites. And so so her first travel goes from Bermuda to Turks Island. And so that's actually the pathway in terms of what I've been doing in my research. I began the research in Bermuda and then later took another trip to Grand Turk.
So what kind of visual evidence or relics are there of her experience? From what I've little I've seen, it seems to me there are some kind of surprising, let's say, reminders of that slave experience?
Mm-hmm. Well, the Salinas are still there. They are, you know, not obviously in the same form, but you can still see evidence of the places where the enslaved had to stand in the water to engage in this really backbreaking labor of harvesting the salt. Those Salinas, I consider them to be a living archive where you can see the landscape still bearing traces of that labor. And there are also the island, one of the, I would say it's actually a charming feature of the island until you know the history. There are all these donkeys, these wild donkeys that just wander around the island, and they are left over from the salt trade because they were used to pull the wagons carrying the salt. And in some ways, that was helpful in terms of, you know, otherwise the enslaved would be engaged in that labor. And the donkeys are still there, the archives are still there, and the descendants of the enslaved are still there, although not Mary Prince, because she eventually left Turks Island, returning to Bermuda, eventually to Antigua, and then ultimately in England, where she found her freedom at last.
Well, let's delve into this narration of hers, which, as you have said, sounds very much like it's in her voice. It doesn't seem to have any, from the excerpts I've read, it doesn't seem to have any of the literary flourishes that you'd expect from the early 19th century.
Well, I think they tried to preserve, the ghostwriters say that they were ministers, Moravian ministers, that they tried to preserve as much of the sense and feeling of the way that she spoke as they could. We have no way of judging that. But, you know, you can hear the direct appeal that she makes to the people of England who she wants to educate about the situation and hopefully convince them to end not just the trade itself, but the entire institution of slavery.
She's born in the British colony of Bermuda in 1788.
That's right. I believe that's the date of her date of birth.
What do we know about her family?
She is born in a place called Brackish Pond on a farm. Her mother was a household slave, and her father was a sawyer. So he was a tradesman, but also enslaved, belonging to a shipbuilder at Crow Lane. And when I was in Bermuda, there's actually a plaque commemorating where Crow Lane is. So, there is a way of noting the places where that appear in the history of Mary Prince. You can, to some extent, not all of them, but you can find some of these sites in Bermuda. So, she grew up with access, to her family, but immediately she did not have, as true of most men and women held in slavery, a real childhood, because almost immediately she was given to, being brought into the service and the brutality of the institution.
Was Bermuda a slave-based economy?
Yes, certainly. Like most states, most islands in the Caribbean, it was producing, most of the things, the items that we would expect in terms of, plantation slavery, which really transformed the land to produce products that would then become part of the triangle trade, many of them outgrowths of sugar. So the primary products would be sugarcane, and the sugarcane would be refined into sugar, but also the kind of white sugar that we know now, but also a byproduct would be rum. So sugar, rum, and then the salt islands were more unusual. But and so you had to have a very particular topography to produce salt. So that's part of why that's not quite as well known as the other. But certainly, sugar was the primary export in much of the Caribbean.
So what kind of experience did she have as a slave in Bermuda? Was she a domestic slave?
She worked in really all capacities. So domestic labor, certainly looking after children, but also working within the household, the various tasks that even so-called house slaves participated in would have involved really backbreaking labor of laundry, cooking. All of those domestic tasks were very laborious, but she also worked in the field as well. Frequently, though, she was given to have to either look out after the children of her master and mistress.
What kind of environment was it? I mean, a family environment on the surface, but how did that work for Mary Prince, and how long was she in that environment?
Well, it's right. A family environment is an interesting way to describe it. And one of the things that's interesting is that Prince notes that the master and mistress treat each other and their children poorly as well. But some of the descriptions that she gives of experience there are repeated whippings, their sleep being neglected, being forced to, stay up at night, overcome by fatigue, and then begin the whole experience again. She tells stories of a woman named Hetty, who was a fellow slave of hers, who essentially was beaten to death while pregnant and miscarried the child. So even within, this space of a situation where they were caring for children and doing domestic labor, there were still brutal circumstances. And then she describes in her narrative of how after Hetty died, then all of her labors fell to her. So then she was also engaged in, milking the cows and during the work of the house. In her own words, she says, "There was no end to my toils, no end to my blows. I lay down at night and rose up in the morning in fear and sorrow, and often wished that, like poor Hetty, I could escape this bondage and be at rest in the grave.
You have to wonder, don't you, about the psychology of at least some slave owners, because we hear this story. We've even seen photographs in some cases of slaves who are, to put it in crass terms, valuable property, expensive property. Why would it be practical for an owner to, whip a slave to death or into a position of not being able to work? It's as if there's some kind of sociopathic psychology there for some of these slave owners that's beyond any kind of practical consideration.
Certainly. It's a question that my students ask all the time. If we bracket the moral question, how is this good business, right? But what you have to understand is that the institution itself is a morally reprehensible and corrupting one. And to give someone that kind of power over another, the result is in a warping understanding of the humanity of the slave and also the humanity of the slaveholder. So what happens is a very masochistic and sadistic practice of engaging in these kinds of brutal, commonplace, brutal punishments, sexual assault. All of these things were part and parcel of slavery's quotidian experience. And again, it does seem as if, like, well, wouldn't you at least value the life of the people, at least in terms of the labor? But they just did not value that life. And then the kind of inherent cruelty that it developed. One of the things that Prince says in her own narrative is she says, "Since I have been here, I have often wondered how English people can go out into the West Indies and act in such a beastly manner. But when they go to the West Indies, they forget God and all feeling of shame." So even Mary Prince herself understood that psychological transformation and the corruption that occurred from owning another human being. Also, there was just an extent that people just saw the enslaved that they were bringing from, at least in the Caribbean, as almost expendable, right? So they would continue to replenish their labor force with while the slave trade was operating with new recruits, so to speak. And so that was part of why they felt like they would just work people to death to extract the maximum amount of labor and then just replenish it. It was only after the trade stopped, the slave trade itself, that then there was more cognizance that, okay, well, we're not going to be able to continue to get new African captives. We are going to need to figure out how to sustain this through reproducing from the stock that we have.
So I suppose it makes sense. I never thought about it. Did the price of slaves go up when the importation was outlawed? It was, 1807 in the English colonies, and it was 1808 in America?
Well, it did. There were still some clandestine. We know that even after the slave trade was stopped in British and in the United States, that there were still illegal, to put it in quotes, slave ships still going to the coast of Africa and bringing people in. But certainly the prices would have increased. But then you also, at that point, they developed a fairly efficient system of through systematic sexual coercion of reproducing the population.
And when you talk about sexual coercion, that would mean that somebody who was half white, half black would still be a slave.
Right. Well, in the United States, the rule is that slavery is passed down. One follows the condition of the mother. So if your mother was a slave, you would be a slave. And that was practiced similarly in the Caribbean, although not always the same, because, again, you remember you have Some parts of the Caribbean governed by the French, by the English, and by the Spanish, and to some extent also by the Dutch and the Danish. And so in every case, you might come into different kinds of codes and laws about how and when someone would have a route to emancipation. But for the most part, the way that people were allowed to continue to keep people enslaved was to ensure that it would be passed down through the maternal, through the mother.
We're going to follow the fortunes and misfortunes of slave Mary Prince right after this on University of the Air. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Shireen Sherard Johnson, and she has done research into the life of Mary Prince, who was a slave in the Caribbean in the closing years of the 18th century, the early years of the 19th. And what makes her unusual is that she actually narrated the story of her experience as a slave. And as I think we'll see a little later, that narration had some impact upon thinking about slavery in the English colonies. We've determined that she started out, Mary Prince, as what would be called a household slave in her birth country or colony, which was Bermuda, in 1788. And things were not that pleasant for her even as a domestic slave. But this family that she was enslaved to also was pretty rough on their own children. So it was a bad environment all the way around by the sound of it. But how long did that go on?
So she was with that family for, some time, and then eventually they decided to loan her out to she became loaned out to a Salinas on an island of Grand Turk. So she ended up traveling 4 weeks at sea on the way to from Bermuda to what would now be considered the Turks and Caicos, then described as Turks Island. And her new master there was one of the owners of the salt ponds. And so that's where she worked in the Salinas, which were environments, ponds or pools that were used for cultivating salt. Essentially moving it through a series of sluices and eventually drying and transporting the salt to boats to be sent and to be sent out throughout the Caribbean.
So she's,
and eventually into the colonies, she's in the U.S. And abroad.
She's a domestic slave in Bermuda, and for some reason somebody thought that she would be good at hard labor.
It was really about what she'd be good at. I think it was just a hand, right? They needed people to do this work, and it had nothing to do with a skill or concern or aptitude. She was just another body to work at this task. And she describes how, when she after, so I think you'd asked earlier about how much time. So she was 5 years with this captain, and then he lent her out to, this new master, in Turks and Caicos. And she was there for some time. And this was really, for her, the worst experience under slavery was working in the salt, in the Salinas and on Turks Island.
Yeah, well, as we heard from your quotation from her narrative at the beginning of this conversation, working hours under the hot sun, immersed, from the knees down in salt water, which did have a corrosive effect on everybody who was working, whether they were male or female in that environment. But how long could she stand that kind of work before she just physically would be rendered useless as a slave?
She describes it as actually experiencing becoming a human pickle. That's how they describe it, by standing in the salt water. If you think about the process of pickling that we use to preserve vegetables,
right?
That is the experience of what it means to work, in that manner. Even after she gains her freedom, her health has been so
compromised,
destroyed. Yeah. Right, by those experiences that she continues, that she has ailments that persist even when she is no longer enslaved.
So how long could she even work in that environment? How long could she work in those salt ponds?
Norman, that's not something that I could answer.
But
I think it's hard to ask that question. How much pain and suffering can a human body take? We don't have numbers or records. We only have her own account there. Overall, in the Caribbean, the life expectancy was low, right, in terms of how long people could survive in the plantation slavery environment, whether it was on a cane plantation or in other kinds of labor. So Prince was happy to leave Turks Island, but it did not alleviate her suffering.
How did she manage to get out of that?
At some point, the period of loan was at an end, and so she was returned to Bermuda for some time. And then eventually, at one point, her owner, who was a man then named Mr. Wood, took her with him to Antigua. And so that was actually where she met her husband, who she married. But also, there were other hardships. She became ill with rheumatism, which crippled her, made it difficult for her to walk. And at this point, she was caring for children, but it was, definitely difficult because she was disabled at this point.
So she was bought by this Mr. Wood to be a domestic slave again?
That's the care. That's primarily the work that she did, was primarily caring for children, but also doing the laundry and other kinds of labor. Then again, it's not field labor, but it still was pretty strenuous labor.
Well, what was the family structure then for her now that she's married? She's owned by one person. Did he also own her husband?
So after she was married, there was a sense, or I think there was a hope that, perhaps maybe she would be able to find her freedom with her husband, but then eventually they traveled to England, which she separated from her husband. And her owner was actually really unhappy to hear about her marriage. Ultimately, both in the U.S. as well as in the Caribbean, the idea of what we would think of as a marriage was not legal. Right, because nobody, the master had complete control, the owners had complete control over the slaves. So marriage bonds would be a contract that would subvert the ownership. And so marriage, for the most part, was illegal. And yet people did marry, especially in the church. And so she was married in the Moravian church. And her owner at that point was unhappy about the marriage, especially because her husband was a free man. And he would have preferred to for his wife to also be free, because that would have been, it was an untenable circumstance.
To have one free and the other still a slave.
Yes. And she says in her book that she had not much, I had not much happiness in my marriage owing to my being a slave.
I would think so. It's hard to imagine, first of all, how her owner could have even, what shall we say, how she could have gotten married without her owner's consent if he actually owned her. How could she get married if he didn't approve of that? Was this something she did in secret in the Moravian Church, or do you have a sense of how that whole thing came about?
Well, we have the story, right, that she tells. Certainly, I think that in any circumstance of oppression, people find ways of asserting their own agency and desires if they have to, go around in secret to do so. When she became converted within the church, marriage was then considered an important sacrament of being, a Christian,
yes.
Right? So I think it was something that was important to her to do. And I think she was certainly going against what would have been the tradition and going against her master's desires, but she was asserting her rights or what she felt was her, inane rights, right, or her innate rights to seek to be joined with a person of her choice.
And how did that play out then, once you have Mary Prince, a slave, married to a free man?
Well, not well, right? She was certainly being still forced to labor and serve her family. Mr. and Mrs. Wood, in general, had, continuous demands. And eventually they took her with them to England. And, she was willing to go, I think, because, one, I think she was hoping to find some treatment for her ailments, especially rheumatism. But what she knew was that perhaps if she could get to England, that it would be within her power, within her grasp to achieve her freedom. And so, she left to go with them, to care for their children in England. And then pretty much shortly after she got there, she knew that she needed to leave as soon as possible.
Well, what was the status of slaves in England? There certainly wasn't slavery as such in England.
Well, that's debatable.
Really?
Simon Newman, who's a historian, and who's worked on the history of slavery in England, there were certainly people held in bondage before the time that Mary Prince arrives. But once Mary Prince arrives, there's this idea that goes around that says that, the air in England is too pure for any slave to breathe, right? So, and if she wished to be free, she could, she simply has to leave and sort of declare herself. That was true and not true, right? So there had been people, smaller numbers surely, nothing like in the colonies, but people who had been held in slavery in England. They often appeared in the papers, especially in the 18th century, in runaway ads. So we know that people, ship captains and other people in the trade, did bring their slaves to London and to England. But at the time of Mary Prince's the fact that they transport her to England, that allows her the opportunity to gain her freedom.
Did she?
She does. Yeah. She contacts the Anti-Slavery Society and the Moravian Church, friends that she has made there, and goes to their office, and then they work with her to find, shelter, and eventually to tell her story. When she goes into the service of Mr. and Mrs. Pringle, the Pringles are the ones who help her, narrate this. And I think the history is meant to add, to be a testimony, right, to add to the case for her freedom.
We're going to look more closely at the final years of Mary Prince as much as we know anyway, and also the impact that her narration had in England in a time when slavery was still flourishing in much of the Western Hemisphere. When we return in a moment, this is University of the Air. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Shereen Sherard Johnson, and we're looking at the life of Mary Prince, who was born a slave in Bermuda in 1788 and worked as a slave in the Caribbean in the early years of the 19th century. Marries while she's in the Caribbean as a slave, marries a free man, a free black man, and now they've come to England where things might be a little different. And let's see if we can pick up the story of Mary Prince and follow it to where she tells the story of her life as a slave. So once she's in England, what is her status?
So once Prince comes to England, she's very much aware that if she leaves the family, if she leaves her master and mistress, that she can essentially leave them of her own free will and declare herself free in England. And this is what she does. And so she works with the Anti-Slavery Society and the Moravian Church, who help her to get away. And from then on, she, you know, she sees herself as a free woman. Her owners, however, do really everything they can to get her to return to Antigua and try and convince her that if she does this, she will be, you know, better off. She can reunite with her husband, but she does not. And she, while she's there, she then, this is when she dictates the narrative that will come to be published as the history of Mary Prince.
And this would be, what, about 1831 or so that the book comes out?
The book is published in 1831. Yes, the letters and the cases that are, you know, beginning advocating for her freedom, you know, some of those letters are dated from 1828, 1829.
And what's the response in England to that book?
Well, I think these are the kinds of things that, you know, it's difficult to note circulation impact, having records of that. But it was certainly a unique story. The fact that there are people who essentially take her to court challenging her testimony suggests that it is being read widely enough that it is, you know, telling a story that is disturbing to her owners and especially to those who are interested in continuing slavery. And so it adds, it becomes an important and powerful document in the abolitionist cause.
Which I gather gets some momentum as the century goes on, as of course, as we know, England did finally abolish slavery in the colonies. And some places, I guess it was more easily abolished than others. If we go back to homeland, the home colony of Mary Prince, we find slavery gets abolished there fairly quickly. Is that right?
Well, the Slavery Abolition Act in 1833, many of these, there are various, a succession of acts that slowly end first the slave trade and then the practice of it. Keeping many people in almost a kind of status of indenture, you know, and then gradually
buying their freedom
with a gradual emancipation. But I think, you know, by 1840, right, most of these things, these indentures were to were supposed to have ceased by then.
What becomes of Mary Prince?
We don't really know. We have, you know, this document of her life. We know that it was not her, you know, that she does not return, you know, she doesn't return to Antigua with her husband. So presumably she remains in England. And again, we presume that she dies sometime after 1833.
Were there other narratives to follow, other slave narratives, especially from Black women?
So a lot of the stories, I think, that you can find about the experience of slavery, especially experience of enslaved women in the Caribbean, are found within other narratives, right? So there's, and often these are narratives by white slave owners, some of them by naturalists who traveled through the Caribbean and wrote down experiences. Again, this is, it's not like in the United States where you have things like papers like Frederick Douglass's newspaper and outlets for publishing these stories quite in the same way. There's a slave narrative about a woman named Joanna who was from Suriname that is published in the American abolitionist Lydia Maria Child reprints this story. But it's really a story. It's not her story. It's about her, but it's not a story told in her own words in the same way. One of the things we do have, though, is the story of not of a free woman named Mary Seacole, entitled The Wonderful Adventures of Mary Seacole, which is published in 1857. And that's a story of a free woman of color who travels is born in Jamaica, travels throughout the Caribbean, Panama, and eventually finds herself in the Crimean Peninsula. She's known both as a Black British a version of Florence Nightingale.
Wow, so, during the Crimean War.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and her story is written in her own words, but it's not a slave narrative, it's a travel narrative.
Does she ever, Mary Seacole, does she ever run into a situation where somebody questions her freedom? Or is she so far removed from that part of the world that it doesn't come up?
Well, you know, she certainly moves through spaces and has to make and has her own opinions and talks about slavery in her text. She's very cognizant of her status as a woman of color, as precarious. So she does a lot of things to create distance in her writing between herself and when she encounters, especially when she's in Panama, she does encounter people, even people from the United States, because this is during the time when the canal and is being built. And there are people from really all over the global South in Panama during that time. So she's very careful to reinforce her status as a free woman and as a respectable woman, as a protective element. But she doesn't ever end up in a situation where she would be remanded into enslavement in any way.
Was she born free?
Yes. She's born, and I think she describes herself as being a mixture of Jamaican and Scottish ancestry, but really identifies as a British subject, and Seacole, and eventually she makes her way, and eventually she dies in England. And it took many years to recognize her story, but now they have their statues, and her story is being, it's been made into a play. I think there's a lot of interest in recovering her as a heroine. It's really, I mean, the narrative itself is wonderful to read. You know, it's called The Wonderful Adventures, and it really goes against the kind of movement and activity that you imagine that a woman of her background would be able to do during that period.
Well, yeah, the title itself, The Wonderful Adventures, right away, that stands out from these other narratives. She wrote this herself. She was an educated woman.
Yeah, she was able to write this. I think, you know, at different points she might have had some, you know, there's some collaboration. She includes letters in the text, but Mary Seacole's work is, and unlike Mary Prince, Mary Seacole's work is written.
She
writes it herself.
Does she say anything about slavery?
She does. But again, as I said, she's very anxious to separate her own experience from slavery, but she does include the stories of enslaved women, especially those she encounters in Panama, and she is very critical. She's particularly critical of the U.S. Slavery, and less so of other kinds, right? As you know, she just of other people, but she in particular is critical of what she sees as the Southern ideas around white supremacy and the treatment of slaves that she encounters in Panama.
Let's circle back to what we touched on at the beginning here, this what I'm calling sort of slave narrative travelogue that you have been embarking upon, and your writing project following the footsteps of Mary Prince. How is that project proceeding, or is it completed?
Well, I really wanted to visit every island, with the exception of England. I have been to England, but I'm not writing about it. I wanted to visit Bermuda, Grand Turk, which I did. And so two of the pieces have been published about her experiences in both those spaces. And I had plans to also visit Antigua, but they were delayed by the pandemic in terms of travel. But yeah, right. My idea was to go to each of these places, and not so much to try and attempt to find new archival material about Prince specifically, but more to just immerse myself again in those spaces that she would have encountered 150, almost 200 years ago, and try and see if I could recover some sense of a voice or an experience that isn't found within the text itself.
Well, it must certainly bring it all home and make it more tangible when you can actually see the places, and some of which probably haven't changed that much in those years since Mary Prince's time.
Well, Bermuda is dramatically different, right?
Yes.
It's been, I think it's a very different island from something like Grand Turk, which isn't as both, you know, when they obviously after the plantation economies were no longer successful, many islands of the Caribbean turned to tourism, and so that has led to very different development. So, Bermuda, there are placards, and there is an African diaspora history trail that are attempting to preserve those sites and mark them with plaques so that some of that history is maintained. But the experience there, and I write about this in the essays, is somewhat different than when we visit Grand Turk, which, again, has preserved more of the landscape and the natural environment.
How did you discover Mary Prince?
Well, I regularly teach both African-American and Caribbean literature. I teach a class on women's writing in the Caribbean, and I always like to start, at least in that class, with some of the earliest texts that we know. And so the history of Mary, that's how I discovered, you know, the history of Mary Prince has always been one of the first writings that I teach, just to give people a sense of how the story of women and in the Caribbean has evolved over time.
What did you find particularly attractive about her particular narration?
Well, We just only have even though we do, again, you have these narratives in the U.S. context that we're really familiar with, but having someone give an eyewitness account, even if it's being told to someone else, of what the experience, the very visceral experience of what it meant to be held in bondage, in their own words, and also putting it into the context of, you know, using this story to hopefully advocate for the abolition of slavery is pretty powerful. It's a difficult narrative to read. I think you could hear from some of the passages. Those are not easy passages to hear and to listen to, but they are important because they give us a sense of the kinds of brutality that human beings were subjected to. And it really works against any idea of slavery as being benevolent or less harsh or maybe not so bad, you know, which you sometimes do, those kinds of justifications that you hear sometimes.
Yeah, I noticed she says at one point, Mary Prince says, "I have been a slave myself. I know what slaves feel. I can tell by myself what other slaves feel and by what they have told me." The man that says slaves be quite happy in slavery, that they don't want to be free, the man is either ignorant or a lying person. I never heard a slave say so. I never heard a bukra, a white man, say so, till I heard tell of it in England. So she was a little startled to think that anybody would have the idea that slavery was happy, a happy experience for anybody. You have an essay called Salt Works that maybe would be just the thing to close with.
Mm-hmm. Certainly, yeah. So Salt Works traces, again, it's one of the island where she was loaned out to work in the Salinas. And I can read a little bit there because I think it tells about the story of Mary Prince, but also how that story continues to have impact in my life. I brought my family with me to Grand Turk on the trail of Mary Prince, author of the 1831 slave narrative, The History of Mary Prince. For 10 years of her enslavement, Prince was loaned out to a salt rigger. Beset by storms and arrested by calms, she endured a four-week journey from Devil's Island, commonly known as Bermuda, to arrive on Turk's Island, a small isle bounded by a huge seawall. 300 yards from the shore, the reef drops off 7,000 feet. Standing on the beach, shading my eyes from the sun, I can see the exact point where the waves break. The wall ensures inshore water is easy to swim and snorkel. Home to one of the largest coral reefs in the world, Grand Turk draws on an international community of certified deep sea divers to Pillory Beach, where my family is lodged at a dive resort. The beach's sinister name resurrects aspects of the island's history that have nothing to do with reefs, blue water, and white sand. A pillory was a device made of a wooden or metal framework erected on a post with holes for securing the head and hands formerly used for punishment by public humiliation and further physical abuse. Standing for hours in the brine, the salt workers endured boils from the pickle, infected welts from mosquitoes, and constant dehydration. Those who could not keep up would be put in the stocks, the pillory, on this Eponius beach.
From the essay Salt Works by my guest for this hour of University of the Air, Shereen Sherrard Johnson, professor of English at UW-Madison. We've been talking mostly about the narrative of Mary Prince told by a slave who managed to escape in England. And we know little of the rest of her story, though, but it's been very illuminating to hear these narrations from her experiences as a slave. Thank you very much for enlightening us, Shereen.
Thank you, Harmon. I appreciate the opportunity, and I hope that people will seek out the history of Mary Prince and read it on their own.
And maybe next time we'll get to ask you about your biography of Dorothy West.
Sure.
Looking forward to that. I'm Norman Gilliland, and I hope you can join me next time around for University of the Air.